Going through Genesis has been like looking at some paintings of the Christian life in a picture form, with the various patriarchs and their lives and their decisions, the experiences they had. It's like we can get right in and under their skin and see what they're seeing and feel what they're feeling and understand their walk with God and how it really relates to ours. Fascinating of these passages, we've looked at the life of Abraham particularly, who is the father of our faith. And Abraham, he had a son, Isaac, and Isaac is going to have some children in this chapter. And what you get in this chapter really, thought originally we were going to go through Genesis much quicker, but there's so much rich information here. We have to really take our time to look and study this portrait very closely. We're going to look at what I would call the tale of two hearts. You certainly have the contrast between Ishmael and Isaac, but you also have a contrast between the sons of Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau are a great illustration of two contrasting hearts as they stand before the Lord and how they approach life. And we can see in us the example and the model of Jacob and Esau. But let's jump in, first of all, to see Abraham's final days. Verse 1, it says, Abraham took a wife again, and her name was Keturah. That is his first wife, Sarah. He has died. He's buried her. A number of years later, he takes another wife. He's still young and strong, I guess, you know, at the age of 100-something. And she bore him 6 more sons. Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua, and you won't remember those names for anything. Except for Midian does stand out. The Midianites come from this guy. Jokshan begot Sheba and Dedan. That sounds familiar when you read certain portions of the scripture in Ezekiel. But this isn't the same Sheba and Dedan in Genesis 10. And then he goes on to the sons of Dedan, Ashurim, Letushim, and Lemumimimim. I do that because I have the same difficulty sometimes looking at these names as you do and wondering the point would be. Yet, for those that would study this, could come to a place of realizing that these people groups, you can track them down. You can find the lineage of some of them. There are actually cities in the area of the East and Saudi Arabia and the surrounding areas and Iraq that bear names similar to these. So it's kind of an interesting thing to track that down. And then he goes on to the sons of Midian, who are Ephath, Epher, Hanak, Abit, the rest of them. We really don't know who these guys are, but these were the children of Keturah. Now, Abraham, it says in verse 5, gave all that he had to Isaac. But Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had while he was still living, and he sent them eastward away from Isaac, his son, to the country of the east. Now, we could really look at Abraham here and go, okay, well, in 1 Chronicles, Keturah, it's called a wife here, but she's called a concubine in 1 Chronicles. And you wonder, what was Abraham thinking if there were other concubines? You look at Abraham, and of course, a lot of people that are ignorant of the Bible and how it informs us about what happened without necessarily approving of it, this would be one of those cases. See, Abraham certainly was a man of faith, but in his culture, it was not uncommon to have a wife and then also a concubine. The concubine wouldn't have legal heirs, but you would still provide for them. And these sons of the concubines, he sent eastward away from Isaac. And unfortunately, the Bible tells us that God intended marriage very plainly in Genesis Chapter 2, very simply, between a man and a woman, one man, one woman, the two become one flesh. This is what God's design is. Later, Jesus reiterated that and expresses this is what marriage is all about. Now, there are those that want to tinker with this now, and some will even point out, well, you know, people had concubines back then. Solomon had 1,000 women in his life. David had a number of wives. You have a number of these kings that married a number of women or had concubines. So what does that mean? Well, God says very plainly, marriage is between one man and one woman. So you can actually know, though God does not specifically rebuke David for his wives, Solomon he does, because he went a little overboard. 700 women, 700 wives, 300 concubines. You know, I can barely take care of one. So I just don't envy that at all. But the point is, they were wrong. And essentially, the problem comes out in David particularly and in Solomon. Solomon's wives took his heart from the Lord. And David, the problem, the intrigue, the difficulty in his own family because of this. And here even in Abraham. Because a lot of these descendants become a huge problem to the descendants of Isaac. And so what were you thinking, man? Abraham, this man of faith. So even these great men of faith had their failings, and there is the cost to it. Now, someone could say, well, you know, they did it, I'll do it, fine, do it. And you find out just how complicated life can be when you tear your family apart by doing this because God did not guide us in this direction. So the Bible tells us, but of course, does not approve of this practice. Now, this is the sum of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, 175 years. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age. Verse 8, and an old man full of years, he was gathered to his people. This is how the Lord puts it. He was gathered to his people. And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zoar the Hittite. That's, if you remember, as he says here, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah, his wife. So where he buried her, now they're burying him. The man of faith dies. Not a great eulogy, but yet what a great lesson of a life. With all the failures that Abraham had, which are not many in the entire life that he had, but nonetheless, he models for us as Christians growing in faith. Adding to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, to brotherly kindness Christian love. This same progression of faith Peter outlines in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. It's a beautiful passage of how we add to our faith. And essentially, none of us start out getting it right away. Certainly, when you first become a Christian, you don't immediately grasp everything that God is and what he wants to do in your life. And you sometimes stumble a little bit and you trip over yourself. And then you learn to trust him as you get to know him better. This is the life of faith. And now Abraham is gone, gathered with his people, 175 years of age. You know, interesting, gathered with your people. Who are his people? He's buried with Sarah. Well, you see, just because his body is in that cave with Sarah alone does not mean that he's not gathering with his people. Why? Because Abraham is still very much alive. In fact, this is the amazing thing when you consider life after death. The Bible is very clear on that. And yet there are actually liberal theologians that don't believe in the resurrection or miracles. Jesus confronted the liberal theologians of his day, the Sadducees they were called. They didn't believe in miracles, the resurrection, angels, and one pastor quipped, that's why they were sad, you see. But seriously, the liberal theologians of Jesus' day, he confronted. In fact, he asked them a question. He goes, the Bible tells us God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Is he the God of the dead or of the living? I mean, they didn't believe in the resurrection, so Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were dead, yet God calls himself the God. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why would God call himself that if they were dead? No, he's not the God of the dead, but he's the God of the living. They're very much alive. And he is gathered with his people, and the day will come when you will be gathered with your people. The big question is, who are your people? Some of my Italian friends talk about my people, they'll say, you know, well, my people look at this life this way. Well, my people, like, well, you know, that's more of a limited scope on earth. One day you'll be gathered together with your people from the standpoint of your heart spiritually. Spiritually speaking, who will you be gathered with? You know, there'll be some gathered with the saints on high to be in the presence of God forever because that's where their heart is. There will be some gathered, the Bible says, some to everlasting life, but some to everlasting shame and contempt. Eternally separated from God because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to respond to the gospel and believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, the only way God has given for us to be saved. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. So who will you be gathered to? I'm reminded of the illustration of the teacher who was mocking the whole idea of Jonah and the whale. How could Jonah possibly have been swallowed by a whale and still survived after 3 days? It's impossible. And he's going through all the science of it and all of the technology. And, you know, he's making a mockery of it. And he goes, who could possibly believe that? And one girl in this class, a Christian, raised her hand and says, I believe it. And he just riveted his attention on her and made a mockery of her and was basically saying, how could it be possibly that this could happen? There's no way that Jonah could have survived. And she goes, well, I still believe it. Well, how is it possible? She goes, I don't know. When I get to heaven, I'll ask him. And he goes, well, what if he's not there? She goes, well, then you can ask him. You got to appreciate the spunk. Well, where will you be gathered? Here he's gathered to his people, and now his life is now a legacy passed on. And now it came to pass after the death of Abraham, verse 11, that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt at Beer Lahai Roi. That is the well of where God sees. God sees me. And then from verse 12 through verse 18, we basically see the genealogy or the account or the generations, the word Toledeth, of Ishmael, Abraham's son. Now, God had promised to Ishmael a blessing that he would be the father of 12 princes, that he would be fruitful, multiply, be very prosperous. And here are the names in verse 13 of the sons of Ishmael. And I'm not going to read these guys, but I'll let you read them if you want. But these are the people, the sons of Ishmael. These were their names by their settlements. And the years of Ishmael's life, verse 17, says they were 137 years. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And here you get the picture that Ishmael was, as God promised, exceedingly prosperous. Where we get this account of his sons probably was at the funeral. When Isaac and Ishmael got together and burying their father, I'm sure that he got the full account because at that time Ishmael was about 90. And his sons are already grown up and they have sons that are probably grown and they're pretty well a full life. But now the focus of the Bible comes on Isaac. Verse 19, it says, this is the genealogy or the account or the record or the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. Remember when he went to Mesopotamia to get his bride and brought her back? This is where they're from. And Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. Now stop there for a second and see the irony here. You have Isaac, the chosen one, who is going, through him, all the descendants are going to come that will eventually bring forth the Messiah. He's the one that's promised his descendants as numerous as the sand of the sea. And yet when you read the record, at least for now, they're barren. They've been married for 20 years and they have no children. He's already 60 now, no kids. And Ishmael, doing quite well, thank you. Now stop for a moment and think about this. It seems that Ishmael really gets the blessing and Isaac does not. And I have to quote the passage of Shakespeare in Hamlet, "Nay, I know not seems." This is our problem many times as believers. We live in this world and we do not understand why that I'm trying to follow the Lord, but my way is not easy. It's a difficult path. And it seems like people who don't want to follow the Lord, man, they're just doing great out there. And I don't get it. Just like the psalmist says in Psalm 73, why are the wicked prospering so? Here you see almost a contradiction. Ishmael's being blessed. Look at him. When they get together, he's already got multitudes. And Isaac, they're barren. And I'm sure after that funeral ceremony, Isaac realizes something's not right here. So it says that he pleads with the Lord, but the Lord granted his plea. Now, it took 20 years before Isaac really got around to really pleading with the Lord. And sometimes, you know, when we go through difficulties, I don't know about your experience, but for me, there is a purification in our prayer life. There is a desperation. There is a desire. God, unless you come through, we're toast. Help us. And that's what the Lord is looking for in his people. But here is how God works. Now, how has God worked in your life? Have you gotten everything you've wanted in regard to your home and your family and your career? Or have you experienced some dead ends? You know, sometimes we experience those dead ends. Do you think God has left you? Do you think He's finished with you? He's not really caring about you? He's not paying attention? In this economy, maybe you lost your job. You've gone through all these experiences. Is God forgotten about you? Well, look at Isaac. He's the one that had all the promise but had really nothing seen. And so he pleads with the Lord, and the Lord answers. And Rebekah, his wife, it says, conceives here. But there's a problem. Verse 22 recounts, but the children struggled together within her, and she said, if all is well, why am I like this? So she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, if I were to take an old quote out of the Bible, and this is old, this is, you're talking 4,000 years old here, and I were to put it into a contemporary package, I can't think of a more appropriate question than this that I think many Christians have asked at some point in their life or many points in their life. If all is well, why am I like this? If all is doing, well, God is in the throne and I'm His child and I've got these wonderful promises, why am I going through this? So she asks this question. I mean, she's gotten pregnant now. She's conceiving. It's wonderful. But now there's another problem. And if everything's right, why am I going through this? Well, the Lord, she inquires of the Lord, which is the wise thing to do. So you're going to the right place. You're seeking the Lord. And she finds out this is beyond a normal pregnancy for this reason. The Lord said to her, verse 23, there are two nations in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So she finds out what's going on. She's going to have twins. She has twins. She's going to bear two sons, and they're going to be two nations. You know, it's interesting just thinking of this pregnancy. You know, it saddens me when I see the lack of care of life in the womb in our culture. We live truly in a culture of death, and I don't think Christians speak up often about it, enough about it, and oftentimes because Christians themselves are guilty of having abortions and not thinking about this life in the womb for convenience. You know, I can't have a child, or, you know, my teenage daughter, you know, I don't want anybody to know, you know, kind of a thing. We have that mentality, and we just don't think that despite the circumstance, God is the one that is the giver of life. And I think that what happens is we get fuzzy in the brain with this because we don't understand the mystery that's going on in the womb. The Bible speaks about us being fearfully, wonderfully made in the womb as God is forming us, more than just the physical body. See, there's a struggle in the womb here because you've got two different temperaments, two different children that even in the womb, now you know kids, they fight after they get out of the womb. Here, two kids fighting in the womb. These are so different. Now, if you're a parent of more than one child, you know very quickly, as soon as that second child is born, oh, this is different. This child's totally different than the you know how different kids are. Now, when I was growing up in college, you know, we had the whole blank slate theory, you know, that all the children are born with a blank slate. And there's no differences. It's the experiences they get from their parents. That's what makes them different in their unique personalities. Nonsense. And those of you who know children from the womb, they're different. And here in the womb, there's a battle going on. But God is the giver of life and the mysteries of our creation. You know, He's the one. Remember, even when Elizabeth was visiting Mary, the mother of our Lord, and she says, oh, my child leaped in the womb when he heard your voice. I mean, even in the womb, there is an awareness that we can't even comprehend. How can we play God and discount that life to meaning less than a child who was born? I tell you, we're going to have a huge culture battle in our lives. And as Christians, I think that is one area we should never compromise on. Never compromise. Once you can discredit that, you can basically go down that road and play God. Then that's just the beginning of many other areas where you will discount what God has to say in the Bible. But here is the answer. There are two nations, two peoples. One person is going to be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. So when her days were fulfilled, verse 24, for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, and he was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Hairy. That's what Esau means. They gave him the name Esau, Hairy. And afterward, his brother came out. We're told later he was smooth-skinned. So one hairy, one smooth. And his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Yaakov. Now they're duking it out in the womb, and they're fighting to see who's going to get born first. And Esau, yeah, he jumps. He's a man's man. He's going to get out first. But Jacob, man, not to be outdone, grabs him by the heel. So that he got the name heel catcher, Yaakov. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So in the birth, striking differences, hairy and smooth. Even before birth, two different temperaments. Fighting out of the womb. You know, the prophecy of two nations, two peoples, and the older serves the younger. That's the strange part of this. But that's also the lesson for us. You see, in these two hearts that we will look at, these contrasting hearts in a moment, let's stop for a minute and just think of how God does things. Here's the oddity. The tradition, even in the law in Deuteronomy 21, there is the law of the firstborn. The firstborn son is the one who gets the double portion. The firstborn son was all important in that culture. Because that son was not just going to get the double portion of all, but he was also going to be the spiritual leader of the family. He's going to offer up the sacrifices on behalf of the family, would be saying prayers for the family, lead spiritually. There's a lot of spiritual connotation to this firstborn status. But here's what God does. There seems to be a little switcheroo here a lot of times. You see, when you look at Seth, he was not the firstborn. He was born third, and yet he was given the prominence, and through him the lineage of the Messiah comes. When you look at the sons of Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, Shem was not the firstborn, yet he was the one through whom the lineage came for the Messiah. Isaac was not the firstborn. You have Ishmael, but he was given the blessing. Jacob and Esau are now born. Jacob is the younger. But it's through Jacob the younger who the lineage of the Messiah will come. And then you go on, and Judah was the fourth son of Jacob. He's the one through whom the Messiah comes. And then David, he was the eighth son of Jesse. And yet he's the one God chose. What's going on here? I'll tell you what's going on here. This is a message. This is a message from heaven about grace. And the Lord actually gives us a commentary on this, so we will know this is a message. In Romans chapter 9, he tells us through Paul the Apostle what's happening here. In verse 10 of Romans 9, he says, when Rebekah had conceived, verse 11, for the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of him who works, but of him who calls. Even it was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. That was unheard of. But the reason is, you see, this is God saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. It's not of the legs and the strength of man, but it's my calling. And it's the same thing for your salvation. Our flesh is like that. We want to take some credit for our spirituality. And sometimes it comes out in a pride. You know, when God awakens our heart and we're alive unto him, we look at all around at all these other people in our family and friends that just aren't getting it. They're not as committed as we are. They're not as dedicated in following the Lord. And what's wrong with them? And do what I'm doing. Look how good I'm doing. What's wrong? And what happens, we begin to attribute to ourselves of this thing that the Lord has done in our lives. How can you, who received this gift of salvation, boast in it as if you didn't receive it? How can you, who receive various gifts and abilities and callings, boast in them because they were a gift? The point is this, it's by grace you've been saved. See, in the natural, Esau appears more vigorous and strong and a man's man. He should be the leader, but God says, no, I've called Jacob. I've called Jacob. The logical human, naturally talented Esau, and seemingly blessed, is bypassed for Jacob. Just as the Bible tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the strong, chosen the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, that no one may boast before him. See, there's one thing the Lord won't tolerate, and that's pride. And sadly, you know what happens is I can recognize, I've been around a long enough time where I can pretty much recognize now when God has put an anointing on some young person. I'll tell my wife, keep an eye on that person. God has his hand on them. God has gifted them. God has given them something special. And you know, that's God's prerogative. And it's not like they're special because of something they're doing. It's like the Lord has given them an awakened heart, an awareness, and a desire for him, just like he did to Jacob. But the danger is, and I watch closely because I know it was in my own experience, where everybody tells them, oh, you're special. Oh, you're different. Oh, you're that. And they begin to listen to it. And they get lifted up in pride. And then God has to discipline them because he does. He's faithful in that. I've been through many secret chastenings of the Lord myself over the years and the time. That's an interesting cell phone. There is something that I think we really need to get with Jacob and Esau in this. And I think this is extremely important. God is sovereign. He chooses. And that's what Paul is saying. Even God chose Abraham. What was special about Abraham? The Bible actually tells us in Ezekiel 16, he says, your mother was a Hittite and your father an Amorite, referring to his people. He's saying, you guys weren't special by pedigree. You weren't special by spirituality. Abraham was worshiping idols in Ur of the Chaldees when he was called, and God revealed to him that was wrong, and he called him out of that. Talk to your Jewish friends about that Abraham was once an idol-worshipping Gentile. He was. That's how he started, until God called him, and that's why it's by grace. And the same thing that you've been saved by grace through faith, and that not of yourself. It's the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. And here we have the same thing. But now let's take a look at the hearts. You see, because both Esau and Jacob, they are different from the womb. God has his hand on Jacob. But Esau still has a number of spiritual benefits. But unfortunately, his heart is not there. And, you know, sadly, there is a lot of example of Esau type people, even in the church, where Jacob is the one we're encouraged to follow and to emulate. So it says in verse 27, the boys grew. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. So you have a contrast already. Esau was a man's man, a skillful hunter, a man of the field. Kind of reminds me of the Ken Graves type. You know, the mountain man from Maine. Yeah. A man's man out there hunting. Wrestling moose down the hill. You know, you get that picture of him. And the interesting thing is the Bible tells us that there is another hunter before the Lord, and that was Nimrod. And then Ishmael was also an archer, a man of the wild. And there's something about these men that make the earth their real heart. And that's exactly where Esau seems to be, but Jacob, he was a mild man. Now, we're going to come back to that word mild because it's not what you think. But it says Isaac, verse 28, loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. There's a little favoritism going on. But listen, Rebekah is right. Not so much to love more, but to regard more because you know by faith God has pointed him out. There's something special about him. Where Isaac loved Esau, why? Because he makes a mean steak. He liked eating of his game. He liked that food. And there's something, you know what, Isaac has lost it here. There's something, he's missed it. And of course, there's going to be a lot more on this that happens in their lives. But for now, at least, an encounter happens between Jacob and Esau that's recorded in the rest of the chapter here that I think is very important to notice for our own lives. Because when we read this, I can tell you most of the time, most of us, and myself included, read this, and we infer from this that Jacob wasn't a very nice guy. He took advantage of his brother. But what we fail to understand is that God does not say that. God actually rebukes Esau for this, and that's the real message here. But let's take a look. Jacob, it says, verse 29, cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with some of that red stew, for I am weary. Therefore, his name was called Edom. Now, there's the etymology of Edom. Edom means red, red stew. He was born all red, if you remember. And literally, when you go to modern-day Edom, which is Jordan, you can actually visit the rock city of Petra, And what you notice on the travel there is that all the ground is red. A lot of the red stone and the iron mixed in the soil makes it a very red place. So there's a lot about red for whatever reason around Esau. And that's why he is now the father of the Edomites, which comes from the word red. Well, Jacob said, "Oh, you want some stew? Okay. Sell me your birthright as of this day." Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die. So what good is this birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. And the Bible tells us, thus Esau despised his birthright. By the word despised, by the way, just understand what it really is. That word has changed over time. In our lingo, it kind of means I loathe it, I despise it. And that's kind of not the original context of the word. The original word simply means to despise it is to take it lightly, just to disregard it like, I don't care about that. Hold it in contempt, like it's no big deal. I need to eat right now. Who cares about the birthright? That's essentially what Esau does. Now, God gives us another commentary on this in Hebrews. Turn with me to Hebrews chapter 12, as this is very important and pertains to us. There is an exhortation in Hebrews 12 about not falling short of the grace of God, not letting any root of bitterness spring up. And verse 16 of chapter 12, he says, "Lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright." Lord doesn't rebuke Jacob for what he did, but he rebukes Esau, who was willing to sell his birthright for a morsel of food. There are three things mentioned in beware of falling short of the grace of God. The first is lest any root of bitterness. That applies to Esau because in the original context of the root of bitterness in Deuteronomy 29, he speaks about those who have it in them whose heart turns away from the Lord. Esau was in a sense a pastor's kid. He had a spiritual heritage. He grew up in the church, if you will. But his heart wasn't there. He had a root of bitterness there. By the way, if you think about bitterness, when a person is bitter, really, when you think about it, they're really not turning it over to the Lord. They're angry with God. They're angry with God why he allowed this. They're angry with the person that hurt them. They're bitter over something, and they just can't get over it. And the root of it is unbelief. You can't see how God can use that for good. You're in prison to that then. Bitterness will destroy you. Esau, that root is there. But he's also called, listen, a fornicator and profane. Fornicator, the word pornos, we get the word pornography from it. He had unrestrained sexual passions. Now, if you want to sum up Esau in two words, food and females, that's Esau. Now, it's funny we look at that, but isn't that very much like people today that don't want the Lord to be in the center? If you're a man and you don't believe in God, food and females. What else is there? The pleasures of this life, being earthbound, and his sexual passions, which are true for any man. They're powerful, any woman too. But the thing of it is, satisfying them outside of God's plan, you will be a pornos. You will be a fornicator or adulterer, as the case is. He says, lest there be any profane person. You know, the word profane means common. You're either profane or holy. You're either common or unique. See, God wants you to be separated, holy unto him, unique for his purposes. But then there's the common of this world. Everybody does it. So it's funny, the same thing your kids say to you, you know, like, "Come on, I want to go to this party. Everybody's going. Everybody else is letting their kids go. And that's exactly why you're not going, buddy. Because you're not everybody. You're special. This is how you got to treat your kids. You've got to train them and you've got to love them by not falling into that trap of them convincing you you don't love them because you're not letting them do what everybody else does. Oh, how many parents fall into this trap? They fall into this craziness of, oh, I need my kids to like me. Hey, your kids have many friends, but they've only got one set of parents. Nevertheless, I digress. I'm getting off on that. The point is this. he was common. Just like anybody else, the animal urges hit me and bleh, I got to go for them. He can't restrain himself. He's earthbound. He's living for the present. And in doing so, he esteemed lightly the birthright, the thing that could really mean something spiritually for him. And you know, the sad thing is, there are many people around us that, well, you look at them and you wonder, is their heart really in the things of God? Are there evidences in your life that you truly are regarding the things of God more important than the things on this earth? Is there evidence of that? Well, I can tell you right now, where do you spend your time and your treasure? Where you put your time and where you put your treasure, which is another form of your time, by the way. The money you earn, you exchange your time for that money. So that money represents your time. And though the world might tell you, oh, time is money, young man, emphasizing the importance of time because money is more important. Time is money, 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 money. So protect your time because it's money, money, money. Well, a Christian should say the opposite. She'd say, young man, money is time. So you better protect your money because it represents something much more valuable, your time. Your time is so valuable. You only have so much time in this world. And then it's gone. Then you've got all eternity. What are you doing with that time? Which is represented by the time you give to serve and the treasure that you give for the kingdom. Where is it? Now, I think in many Christians, when you think about it, they're like Esau in this. They're esteeming lightly the kingdom. And they're proving this by where they're spending their time and their treasure. Look at their checkbook. Sometimes much more revealing than the marks in their Bible is the marks in their checkbook. Where they're spending their money, where they're putting their time. And I think it's important when you think about this. Paul exhorted the Corinthians. He said he was going to send his letter ahead of time so that when they came through, they were going to collect an offering that the people had promised the year before. So they kind of made in their minds. And he says, look, I don't want anybody to be giving in a begrudging way. I want you guys to know ahead of time, I just want you to do what you purposed in your heart. And that's how you should give as Christians today, how you purpose in your heart. That is, you plan ahead of time what you intend to do. Like, you plan to be committed in a certain ministry, and you commit to a certain percentage of your income to the things of God. That is what a Christian does. You want to set that apart. But here, you purpose in your heart. Right? So purpose in your heart, make up your mind, and then just follow through with that. Now, purposing is different than just proposing. When I propose to do something, I'm just coming under advisory and some thinking about it. I'm proposing in my mind to do something. When I purpose in my heart, I've made my mind up. See, I make my mind up at the beginning of the year what I'm going to give. Make up my mind, and I trust the Lord with that, and I go through with that. I make up my mind where I'm going to serve. Because listen, if you don't make a commitment somewhere, like if you don't get committed to a ministry and you just say, well, if I feel like it, I'm going to show up. If I feel like it, I'll give. It won't happen. You have to purpose in your heart. So in a way, here is Esau, whose purpose really is earthbound, and Jacob is different. Now we come to Jacob now. Let's look at him for a moment. You know, Jacob was a tent dweller. You know, he's following Abraham's example. He was called a mild man. Well, that word, I told you I'd come back to it. It means literally, it's the word tam, which means perfect, really, complete. He was a complete man. He wasn't just limited to the needs that he had here in this world. He was interested in spiritual reality. He was interested beyond just the temporary pleasures. But I fear in our generation, you see, there are a lot of young people who've grown up in the church like Esau, who get to a point where it really shows they're not interested in the things of God. You see, God has to call them and draw them. And as a parent, you know, you pray for that. You pray for that evidence to be seen in their heart. But the bottom line is, who really cares about spiritual things? You know, Esau regretted later selling his birthright. But the reason he regretted, and I believe here's where Jacob, if you look at from God's perspective, Jacob actually did the right thing here, and I'll tell you why. Jacob, by doing this little sale, he's testing Esau's heart. I'm thinking, if I'm Jacob, I'm thinking, well, my brother's hungry, needs some food. I'll offer him some food for the birthright. He'll never say yes. There's no way. No one would be that stupid. And he finds out his brother is that stupid. It's like, wow, if my brother so lightly esteems something that important, then he doesn't deserve it. And I'll tell you what, you know, I think of Jacob who desired the things. He knew Esau would just strip the birthright of its material blessing. That's the only part of it that was material. You get double portion. But all the other things were spiritual, and it was obvious Esau didn't care about that because he would trade it for a cup of stew right now. You know, sadly, there are those that also look at ministry this way. See, sometimes people look at ministers or a successful church and they look at, wow, you know, attention and honor and importance and, you know, look how successful they are. And every great move of God began with the Lord working among people. Every denomination, if you think about it, whether it's Methodist or Presbyterian or Baptist or, you know, Episcopalian, a lot of these movements started as movements of God moving in people's lives. Calvary Chapel in the 60s with the hippies was a move of God. And he began that work. But and in the beginning, the hippies didn't have anything, right? All they had was their love of the Lord and his word. But as time goes on, I mean, it's like God is drawing people and churches are popping up all over the place and lots of churches are mega churches among the Calvaries and people are coming, they're hungry for the word of God and people begin to kind of come in. And the Bible says that just like the kingdom of heaven, it's like a big tree, Jesus said, where it grows like from a little tiny thing to this huge tree, but and the birds of the air nest in the branches. And it happens in any church where after a while, those that have ambition, worldly ambition, start to intrude in areas of ministry. They look at the ego needs that could be met from people that are serving in the Lord, and they like that. And they like the worldly, earthly aspects to it. And sometimes they will even malign your motive because they'll assume everybody has the same motive, and the pastor's just in it for the money or the attention or the fame, you know, and so everybody's like that. And of course, the world looks at churches that way because they can't really believe anybody really has a pure motive because they don't. And there will be people with ambition who will intrude. And it happened in David's life as Absalom, his son, had ambition to take over the kingdom. It's damaging to any church when worldly people and they climb the ladder and eventually take over the whole denomination. And you know, in many places, it can become very worldly even in the church. And here it's because of Esau. So I think, honestly, Jacob was probably disturbed that his father could not see the lack of spiritual heart in Esau. The bottom line is, we really get what we want. See, Esau got what he wanted. He got his cup of soup. And Jacob got what he wanted. He wanted the birthright. He valued the spiritual side to that. Bottom line, you get what you want. Adulterers, thieves, homosexuals, pastors, they get what they want. You see, what you want the most. My wrestling coach used to put it to me this way. He says, look, I was trying to diet, break, cut weight to get down to a certain weight class to wrestle, and I'd come in, I'd complain how hard it was. It's so hard. My friends are eating banana splits in front of me. Coach, it's not fair, you know. And he'd say, I don't care. He says, you'll do what you want to do the most. If you want to eat more than you want to wrestle at that weight, then you'll eat more. If you want to wrestle at that weight more than you want to eat, then you'll wrestle at that weight. So whatever you want to do the most, you'll do. I hated his logic. It was too infuriatingly simple. But it was true. And it's true for you as a Christian. You are going to do what you want to do the most. Now, it's encouraging to me that you're here. You want to be here. You want to grow. You want to learn his word. But sometimes there are other things that can come in as well. And here's where we get purified. Looking at Esau and Jacob is a great lesson. God called Jacob. He gave him that heart. And Jacob seeks after the things of God, where someone like Esau only seeks the birthright for the material side. Just like there are people today, if you ask anybody, you want to go to heaven? What will they say? Of course. Why? Because they perceive heaven as a really cool benefit. Like, come on, streets of gold, palaces, mansions, all that sort of thing. Sounds really cool. But a true Christian, when they think of heaven, a true believer, when they think of what heaven will mean, they know that what it really means is the presence of God. You're with him. He who is so amazing. He whose name is I Am That I Am, the all-becoming one. Everything we could possibly imagine is found in Him. Every pleasure forevermore is in Him. It's Him. He's holding all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge in Jesus. Everything about Him. And so that's our desire for heaven. But what a worldly person who wants to go to heaven thinks, well, I guess I have to put up with God when I'm there, but at least I'll be there, you know, kind of a thing. They don't get it. In the meantime, they eat, drink, and are merry here in this world because this is where their real heart is. Now, let's conclude with this thought. How can we have that heart like Jacob to truly value those things of the Lord? You know, the problem is so often we give too much space to the flesh. My wife had a couple of illustrations that I'm borrowing for this message. And one was, if you had 100 acres of ground, and you were going to give Satan just 1 acre. You're keeping 99. That's pretty spiritual. You're just going to let Satan have 1 acre of your territory. You know what he'll do? He'll pick the 1 acre right in the dead center of your property so he can trample every other part of your property to get to his place. And it's true in your life when you give him just an inch, when you give him just a little bit. Your flesh, when you satisfy it, you think it's satisfying the immediate need, it's only going to grow. There was a man desiring to buy a beautiful house for only a fraction of what it's worth, and he kept pestering the owner, and the owner finally cut the deal and says, all right, I'll do it under one condition. In the deed, I'm going to put in the deed that I retain ownership of a nail, a single nail in the front door. The guy goes, oh, sure, that's no problem. You can have that nail. I get the house for a fraction of its value. So he agreed. They sold it. A couple years later, the original owner wanted the house back. So he hung a dead carcass to that nail that he had ownership of and stunk the other owner out. Finally, the other said, I'll sell. I give up. I can't take this stench. Now, obviously, it's not a real story because that would happen. But the illustration is that when you give Satan just a nail. Another very important illustration is a man who was complaining of how much trouble he was having walking with the Lord, how difficult it was. And I get this all the time as a pastor. Pastor, you don't know how hard it is, man. And every place I look, there's all these lusts and all these things. I'm trying to walk with the Lord, but pastor, it's so hard. And as if I don't live in this world and I don't know myself. But one man was complaining this, and a farmer friend told him, you know, in my orchard, there are these children that they kind of know when it's just about time for the apples to fall, and they'll come over before that and they'll hop the fence and they'll beat the trees next to the fence. They'll get the apples and they'll run. He said, so what I've learned to do is a few weeks before they get to the apples, I'll go out there and I'll beat the trees and then the apples will fall. And so I'll get them before the kids get them. But the moral of that story is the trees that are closest to the fence are the ones that get beaten up all the time. And you know what? If you want to not get beaten up by Satan in all of these temptations, stop living so close to the fence. Stop straddling the fence between Christianity and the world. Make up your mind. Draw near in the Lord and you'll find victory over those areas. You know, think about the opportunities you have that Jacob didn't even have. You have versions of the Bible that he would have only coveted for. You have God's word in your laps. You can meditate on the truths. You have commentaries and classes and fellowship opportunities in the church. Read the bulletin. Look at all the things that you can participate in. The benefit if you have the heart for it. Look at the various outreaches. Ladies' dessert night, I mean, they're always finding another excuse to get together. And they have so many great opportunities for women to get plugged in. And I think the radio, what a blessing it is. One lady wrote this from California, listens to me on Bridging the Gap. I got to share this with you because it's just kind of encouraging. She goes, this program has been more than a blessing for me. Every time I have a question or I pray for something, you folks have the answer for me. Obviously, you know, it's the Lord. He does that. She goes, I want to go to visit New Jersey just so I can attend this church. It was also, she says, thanks to this program that I found my Lord. She says, thank you and God bless you. And then she says, P.S., I don't need you to send me a gift for responding. The radio show is all the gift I need. I thought, wow, what a cool thing. Well, as I shared this, some lady from the second service says, you know, this is how we ended up at this church. I used to listen to you on WMCA for 7 years. Every morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, I'd be taking notes. And my husband, you know, finally wanted to move out of Long Island and go to New Jersey. And I fought him their way. We almost divorced over it, she said. And then I realized, wait a minute, that church is in New Jersey. She made a deal with her husband. If we're close to that church, I'll go with you. So they live within 20 minutes. They've been part of the church for the last 7 years here. And I thought, that is so cool. How God uses the radio. But you know what? It's an opportunity to grow, to hear His Word. If you're not within the range of it, you can get it online at bridgefm.org. But to serve God, to know God, you have many, many opportunities. The outreaches, I mean, from nursing home ministry and a prison ministry, visiting five different facilities, the Spanish ministry, simultaneous translation, third service, as those of you who are here know, crisis response ministry that we're getting started with, missions, outreach to Afghanistan for collecting hats and mittens for the orphans, ongoing opportunities for missions, the pastoral care ministries, with the More Than Conquerors, a purity group for men, and the Out of Egypt ministry, those that struggle with same-sex attractions. You know, there are a lot of ex-homosexuals in this fellowship that God has given them victory, given them power over that sin, and the Lord is just filling their life and restoring them. Those that had addictions, and the U-turn for Christ in a most excellent way. There's home groups, there's groups for singles, for junior high, senior high, college and career. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But where is your desire? The opportunities that are there, I want to challenge you to get committed. Put your treasure in the things of God, and there your heart will follow. When you make up your mind at the beginning of the year what you're going to give, keep that. If you're falling behind, make up for that. Make that your top priority. And you know what? You will find when your treasure is there, there your heart will follow. Make your mind up to serve the Lord. You know, so often we get so caught up in ourselves. I want to read to you. I shared this on Wednesday night, but it's from the heart of a child, that oftentimes children are much more receptive and more spiritually minded than adults. And this proves it right here. One of the children in school, her dad got laid off. He was one of 300 who got laid off from his company. And they have three kids in our school. So they're trying to weigh out how they're going to continue affording that. And so they're at dinner time and their little girl prays. And of course, what you would think she would pray, Lord, just help my daddy find a job so that we can continue to go to school. And I pray that you help and provide. And that's not what she prays. You know what she prays? She says, Lord, I pray for the other 299 dads that are also looking for work right now. And I heard that, man, my heart just leaped. I thought, wow, there's the spirit of Jacob. There's a heart for much greater than just what you can get yourself. And I can only pray and hope that this touches you, that because, out of the mouth of babes, this is how we grow. We learn so much from the Lord speaking to us through the lives of those that He's touched. And what a powerful testimony. This little girl gets it. She gets it. Because it's not about us. It's not about my life. Later, Esau, in the end of chapter 26, it says, became a grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Because his heart is there. He marries two Hittite women. And his whole focus is in this world. And eventually becomes the ancestor to the Edomites, who become a big problem to the people of Israel. But Jacob, now we're going to be following his life. And oh, what a story. There's so much in the life of Jacob that as it unfolds from the rest of the chapter all the way through Genesis and him and Joseph, there's so many great illustrations of how we can walk and trust the Lord. And Jacob one day is going to get a name change from heel catcher to Israel, from heel catcher to led by God. And that's essentially the process of growth in our own lives. We start out with that concern for ourselves. And we grow in that understanding by the grace of the Lord to be led by God.